History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And the beauty of it is they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time, ask a few questions. More importantly, be patient enough to listen to what comes back our way. We're going to learn a lot, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. Along the way, not only do we learn a lot, not only are we educated, we're entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today, I am in Rio Linda, California, with 96-year-old Arthur Renetti, Navy veteran of World War II. Rio Linda, a lot of radio listeners hear that, and they think of a particular late talk show host.
Rush Limbaugh.
You heard a few of those Rio Linda jokes?
Oh, yeah, sure. We've been out here about, 30 years? We used to live in Carmichael. We had a bunch of stuff and said, we ought to get some property. Anyway, we've been here about 30 years now.
And you've been in the Sacramento area your whole life.
My whole life, other than being a guest of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Well, yeah, on the USS West Virginia, and we're going to hear about that. You've got a picture of the West Virginia on your wall. I also noticed something else on your wall that I don't know if I've seen before. Your father's and your grandfather's medals from the Italian Army in World War I and even prior.
Yeah.
So there's a long legacy of military in your family.
Yep.
Did your dad ever tell you about anything he did in World War One?
Yeah, he was an alpino of ski troops in the Alps.
Uh-huh.
I think he got hit. He said he got hit in the chest with a piece of shrapnel. He got hit there. That's about it. And my grandfather, I never did meet him. He passed away in Italy, but my father told me about stuff. He was I can't remember which war it was. It was some war in Libya or someplace.
And in the 1800s.
Yeah.
But your father, as you said, an alpino, a mountain trooper in World War One.
Yep.
And he and your mother came here.
My father came here prior. He was 18, I think, and he was not eating too well. So then the war broke out, World War One broke out, so the consul said if he goes back and gets in the Italian army, that they would, after the war, if he got married, they would bring he and my mother back here. So that's what happened.
Hmm.
He went back there, and then they got in. My mother said she cried for a year when she got in, and they hosed them down, you know, for bugs and stuff, and they didn't have anything when they got here. Nothing.
Hmm. Wow.
In fact, my mom told me that next door to where they lived, the guy had he was a garbage man. His name was Paletta. And that's where she got her silverware. They'd pick up the food from restaurants and for the hogs and stuff, and waiters sometimes would throw the forks and knives away. That's where she got her silverware.
Wow.
I know that.
So if you tried to complain about something when you were a kid, it didn't go very far,
It didn't
huh?
go too far, no. No. In fact, I remember when I got discharged, I got home. I think it was February 5th. I can't remember the right date. That night I went out, met guys, you know, I went to school with and everything. Everybody getting discharged, having some beers and stuff. And the next night, same thing, you know, drinking beers at home. And the second night, the next morning, I don't know, 7 o'clock, hand grabbed me by the T-shirt. I slept in my T-shirt. Sat me right up in bed. Arturo, you going to go to work? I've been home 2 days. The old man jerked me right out of bed. Mm-hmm. Go to work. This way it was.
That's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes. No free lunch.
Well, tell me about your childhood here in Sacramento as the son of Italian immigrants, and you had a sister.
Yeah.
What was that childhood like? What kinds of things were you tasked with?
Childhood was great as far as, you know, I was just kids playing. We lived down on 16th and U, and there was a young family that lived right maybe about 7 houses away, Chinese people. The Princeton family, the black people, lived about 3 houses away, and everybody played together. We grew up together, you know, no problems. Great people. In fact, Jackie Princeton and I, we played and played and fighting and playing, and then we went in the service. He went in the Army, and when he come home, I see him. We were the same size when he went in. When he come home, he was about 6'4", huge guy. He grew up to be a huge guy. He says, you want to wrestle, Art? I pass.
Done with that, huh?
Done with that stuff. Great guy. His mom and dad, they were good people. In fact, the whole neighborhood was great, you know. Had a family, lived across the street, had 11 kids. Carter family. Yep.
Do you remember having an idea in your mind of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
No, I had no idea. When I was in high school, I wanted to be a court reporter.
Hmm.
So I took shorthand, Greg shorthand, and transcription, and I got my certificate for 120 words a minute, and the war broke out the year before I graduated. Then when I was graduated, I was working the gas station, too. Everybody, all the guys that wanted to go down and join the service, of course, you know. So he went down to the post office to get in, and they were had so many people. They said, we'll call you when we get an opening. You know, they had so many guys going down there. We got an opening in the Army. You're going to go in the Army, or you're in the Navy, or that's it, you know. That's how we got in.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that news that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
Yeah, I was working for Gordon Wilson at a Tidewater Associated Station on 2nd and Capitol Avenue. In Sacramento. A guy drove in. I go out to, that's when you had to fill them with gas, wash the windshield, wash the headlights, sweep out the floorboards.
Mm-hmm.
He says, they just bombed Pearl Harbor. I'm thinking, oh, yeah? What the hell's Pearl Harbor? I'm serious.
Sure.
I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. So I said, oh, okay. So then I found out, you know, the day of infamy. But I had no idea. I was 17 years old.
And did you go to school the next day?
Yeah.
Were a lot of people talking about it?
Yeah, but most of them didn't know where the hell Pearl Harbor was. I'm serious.
Sure, I believe you. And did you have any Japanese-American classmates?
Yep. Yes, I sure did. I'll tell you a little story. Jimmy Kashiwata, great guy. Anyway, he ended up in the... They took him to an internment camp, of course. He ended up in the 442nd.
Uh-huh. And the reason I ask is, you know, most of us listening to this right now weren't alive during World War II, and we didn't live through these circumstances. But
yeah.
I'm just imagining if I'm a senior in high school and I've got a buddy over there who was born in this country, but his last name is Japanese, just like you were born in this country, but your last name's Italian. And all of a sudden, they're hauling him off somewhere.
Oh, that was terrible. Sacramento had Japanese town, you know, down on 4th Street and stuff. And the Filipinos, when all of a sudden when this happened, the Filipinos are going to attack all the Japanese. And Japanese are great, hardworking people, man. All the ones that I knew were all great people. I felt bad about that. You know, they took everything from them. They had to leave their homes with what they could carry. That's it.
Including your friend.
That's right.
Who then, and at that time, they would have told him, hey, you're not even allowed to be in the armed forces because you're an enemy alien.
That's right.
But he ends up in the 442.
Yeah, 442nd.
And did he make it back?
Yep.
Did you see him afterwards?
Yep. I don't want to tell that story. Anyway, that's when I had that bar out on Franklin Boulevard. And Jimmy was working for Campbell Soup. And there was a young lady that worked there that they lived in the property next to them. They were out by Thornton. They lived in Thornton and on a of farmland, you know. And he used to stop in after he got off work. He'd give his girl a ride home. Well, one night he was in there, and two gentlemen that were out there, that was a bow and arrow country anyway, you know, and they start squawking about the Jap with the white girl, you know.
Mm.
So I went down to him and said, you knock it off. I said, you're going to bite off more than you can chew. And they kept popping off, and I said, Jimmy, he said, I'm going to take care of this. I said, no, just relax. He got up, he went out to the car, and he come in. He had a 30-30 Winchester, model 94. I know he's not even well. Right up to the guy, and click, click. He says, now what do you want to talk about? And the guys just got up off the stool and boom, went out the front door, and that was the end of it. He wouldn't have, you know, I don't think he wouldn't have shot me. He would have whacked them with it, but they were gone.
Well, and so for you, so Pearl Harbor happens. You don't know where Pearl Harbor is, but all of a sudden everybody's signing up to go somewhere.
Without a doubt.
And you didn't wait that long yourself?
No.
When did you enlist in the Navy?
Well, I went down to the post office. I was 17. I didn't, you know, it was right after I got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
I turned 18 in September, and I had to wait. In fact, I wanted to go into the Naval Air Force, and I ended up in gunnery. So they called me when I said, we've got an opening here, and they said, oh, if you join now, you'll get a head start to the boot camp. Then you can go to the Naval Air Force and learn how to fly. Okay, so I joined now, and I ended up in gunnery as a fire controlman.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it.
Yeah, so the promise of someday.
Someday
never came.
It was a good experience, and I loved it. I'm not a bit sorry. I mean, I'm sorry about, you know, the bad part of it, but
sure. As
far as I think every youngster should have about a 2-year experience like that. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Well, I want to hear some of why you feel that way, but I'm also curious, since your father had, you know, experienced war, survived war, been wounded in war, did he have any advice for you before you shipped out?
Nope. Didn't want to. Actually, they didn't want me to, you know, to volunteer. They wanted to wait till you get drafted.
Your parents wanted you to wait to get drafted?
Yeah, because I was, there's no way. Finally, they said, well, go. You want to go, go. And it's a good deal.
Well, what'd you think of boot camp? Where was it, and what was it like?
Farragut, Idaho. It was cold, son of a gun up there, you know. The food was different, but it was okay. I ended up with the measles and the mumps up there and survived that. And then I went to fire control school in Seattle, Washington for 8 weeks. And then I got assigned to, we were supposed to go to a 90-millimeter battery up in Alaska. I was supposed to run the directors there, and they changed that because the 90 millimeters were handled by the Army. Then I got on this 30-day, I went to this Ballard. I was there on that 30, and I got transferred over to the West Virginia.
And how did you feel about that? What did you think of that battleship?
Oh, the battleship was great compared to that other thing.
The destroyer you're on?
Terrible.
You didn't want to spend the whole war on a tin can, huh?
No. The battleship was great. I thought it was great. I was in Sky 2.
And explain to everybody what that means. So you said fire controlman, and some people hear that, they think, oh, he was fighting fires. No, we're talking about a different kind of fire here.
Yeah, the gunnery. We were in gunnery. We took care of the directors, the computers. They had a computer. Stable verticals, which the stable vertical is what controls the firing of the gun. The officer's pulling the trigger, but it won't go off until it's in the right spot because of the gyro compass. If it wasn't like that, you'd be shooting in the water, when you're under moving. Directors, you find the target, you get on it, you rate control, it sends the information down to the computer, the plotting room. They crank it in there, and you watch, and as the crosshairs stay on the target, you take your hands off. If it doesn't, you rate control back on, put it back on, boom.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary battery was the aircraft and did light bombarding. Then the main battery fired for big, bombardment. Or the sea engagement was the last battleship over Surigao Straits. And we were in that one. I was in turret 2, right on the coincidence rangefinder in there. And that's where we had credit for sinking a battleship there. That was the end of surface engagements to the ships.
Haven't had one since. And when you say Sky 2, for people who aren't familiar with your ship.
That's a director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sky 1, Sky 2, Sky 3, Sky 4. Port side, starboard side, on the bow and on the stern. You had four 5-inch 38 turrets on each side. So each director had two turrets.
Mm-hmm.
So if the action was up forward, the Sky 1 would have them two turrets. Sky 2, anything on the side here.
Uh-huh.
And Sky 4 in the back, those two turrets on the other side, and Sky 2, same thing. So two turrets, it's four guns, there's two barrels in the 538s. That was on those ships. And the main battery was 16-inch.
Mm-hmm.
Big.
That's a big gun.
Big gun.
Loud gun.
Yeah, they shot at Iwo Jima. We must have shot, I don't know how many rounds. You still couldn't get those guys.
They were so dug in. Huh?
I mean, you're talking about a ton. Projectile weighs a ton, and it set the fuse on them. So they were even shooting armor piercing into the ground, and couldn't. The guys are tough.
Well, and Iwo Jima, I mean, that's not till February of 1945, but there are lots of things you experienced before that.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, for you coming on the West Virginia itself, were you aware of what that ship had already been through at Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I was aware of that, and it was. They raised it and brought it back to Bremerton. And when I went aboard, it was ship's company. And we just put it all together. Got on and we took off on it in 44. Got out in the start of the Philippine invasion.
Was there anybody still aboard that ship who had survived Pearl Harbor?
Yep.
Did they tell you some of those stories?
Yeah. Yeah, there was what they call them plank owners.
Yeah.
You know, the storekeeper was aboard. He was a chief. Turret 2 gun captain Spud Crawford, he was a boarder. That's the two I know. I don't know if any officers were aboard it or not.
Did that mean anything to you? Did that maybe add some weight to what you were doing?
Oh, yeah. Those guys were on there, got sunken right back. And that Spud Crawford was in the Turret 2 since he was a seaman. And he came up to be turret, a little short guy. He was a head honcho of that turret, that's all.
I guess so. Yeah. Might as well have had his name on it. Well, and had you ever been at sea before you joined the Navy?
No.
Did you get your sea legs right away? Did that take you a while?
It took me a while. I was sicker than a dog on that destroyer.
Like sick. A cork, huh?
Yeah, oh, Jesus, I was sick.
So that's why you like the battleship better.
Yeah, well, yes.
Okay.
Much better.
And we'll hear some of those battleship memories when we come back, from the Battle of Leyte Gulf to Iwo Jima to that kamikaze attack at Okinawa. Find photos and a short video with today's guest, Arthur Renetti of Rio Linda, California, by pulling up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, or you can go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Arthur Renetti of Rio Linda, California. The son of immigrants from Italy, he has spent his entire life around California's capital city of Sacramento, except for his years in the Navy in World War II. We've been talking about his time on the USS West Virginia, a battleship which had been severely damaged at Pearl Harbor on the first day of the war for the U.S., but resurrected and repaired and sent back out to the Pacific in September 1944.
You know, none of these questions are meant to be melodramatic. I'm just honestly curious about your feelings. But, you know, I imagine, okay, here I'm getting on this battleship. I'm still a teenager. This is a ship that just about went under at Pearl Harbor that they had to resurrect.
Yeah.
Something like that could happen to me out here in this war. Did you have a feeling as to whether or not you'd be coming back to Sacramento ever again?
There were times, you know, when I remember the first suicide plane that came in.
Hmm.
I was attached to main battery, so I'm watching. The plane comes in, and it crashed right from here to the wall there from the ship. They shot it down, you know, boom.
Shot it down 20, 30 feet shy of the ship.
And there was about four or five of us standing there. This is the real stuff. You know what I mean? And everybody took off. But I didn't, you know, I had no idea that that's what it was, really the guys trying to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could you have any idea?
So this was a whole new phenomenon to you. I hadn't even considered that.
A whole new ballgame. And there was no John Wayne and them, you know, flying airplanes. That's what I thought would be a lot of fun. But it became a home, you know, and it's good.
What was the most challenging part of your job aboard ship?
When they were in condition red, you were on, four off. Your battle station, four on, four off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's challenging to stay awake a long time like that. You know, you don't sleep. That wasn't anything really challenging. I mean, everybody had their job to do, and you did it.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a problem, you'd help someone, you'd ask someone, and you'd together do it.
And you mentioned you guys got over there for the invasion of the Philippines.
Yeah.
So you support the landings, and then you've got this big, the biggest sea battle in history, the Battle of Leyte Gulf, is happening.
Yeah. That's when all the kamikazes or suicides started in the Philippines. There was a lot of them, man. They're like one day, I think we had 21 different sorties, you know, attacks.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
And what are you doing while that's going on?
I'm a director. Trying to keep them from landing on us.
You're trying to shoot those planes down.
Yeah. You can imagine how hard it is to do.
And how big of a responsibility do you feel in a moment like that?
Well, pretty responsible. We got hit bad by one plane, and that was April 1st in 45 in Buckner Bay in Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
Came right down and hit and took out the 20-millimeter in front of us, and wing bounced off the director, and it went right down to and ended up in the galley.
And I want to talk to you more about that one, but I imagine since that wasn't until closer to the end of the war,
right?
And you've got, you know, these battles leading up to that, that there were probably some close calls before that.
Yep. I can't remember the name of the carrier. CVE, a small carrier, got sunk in Sulu Seas right ahead of us. One plane came in and hit, and they had planes on the deck. They had to abandon ship, put them, you know, and they get them off, pick them out of the water. One ship, one plane, boom.
And you saw that happen.
Uh-huh.
So that has to be a little alarming.
That is.
You know guys are dying.
You keep thinking about it. No, people die.
Yeah.
That was in the Sulu Sea.
Well, and, you know, you talked about Surigao Straits and Lady Gulf and the fact that there hasn't been a battle line Navy battle like that since then, where the ships are, you know, side by side and shelling each other. What was that like? I mean, you're one of the last guys who lived through something like that.
Well, the sea battle, the last surface-to-surface gun was Surigao Straits, right in the Philippines. That was about, we start shooting, it was about 10 o'clock at night. What they call in the naval operation, if you cross their T, they're dead ducks, and that's what we did. They were coming this way, and we crossed their T. We were broadside, and our ship, we fired, I think it was 93 armor-piercing rounds in about 12 minutes or something like that. Just boom, 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 and I can see the projectiles going out. They big orange balls from being hot, you know, they're going through the air, boom. And no change, no change, and we knocked the crap out of them.
I guess so.
Yeah, we didn't lose any ships, nothing. They lost.
Was there anything heading back your way? Any of their fire?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm just looking at my coincidence trainer turret, too, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All I see is what we're going out. They were in big trouble. See, they were coming this way, and we came this way and crossed their T, and they're...
Right, because you've got all the guns on your starboard side.
They can't fire straight up.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky for us.
I guess so.
Yeah.
That's got to be a strange feeling to be in a moment like that.
It was. It was like, you know, it really wasn't a big thing because we were perfect.
Mm-hmm.
The range was perfect. The first salvo right on top of them was perfect. So that makes you really feel like, you know, you're Superman.
Well, there's a lot of lives that are dependent on the work you're doing.
Yeah, and we didn't pick up too many survivors. I think they only picked up about 75. Something like that.
How would you describe the margin for error in what you were doing?
Well, you can't have too much. You can't have that.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, you know, kill a lot of people in the turret. If the guy doesn't wipe the mushrooms, the guys down below setting the powder bags up. You know what I mean? You can't make no mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Or everything blows.
And what about for you personally? What did you have to do to make sure your duties were done correctly?
All I had to do was look in that rangefinder and shoot ranges. And they'd call them down to the plotting room.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had to do. And keep my head on straight because a concussion comes in through the end of those things and slap you right in the head.
Ooh.
The concussion is so great when main battery fires that the armor shields on a 20-millimeter are bent back like that. It bends them back.
Ooh.
That's how big the concussion is.
So if you don't have your headphones on correctly, you're receiving that.
The headphones, they were sound pirate phones.
You know? Yeah.
But I didn't have to talk to that because the guy say the range is down.
Uh-huh.
All I had to do was shoot him in there. I have a coincidence rangefinder, splits the target, and you bring it together.
Uh-huh.
That gives you the range.
Gotcha.
A stereoscopic rangefinder, which is the director's, that's reticules, and you bring them this way. And people that has stereoscopic vision, what they call stereoscopic, you can do that good.
Yeah.
See, if you don't have that kind of vision, you have a hard time lining them up like that.
When something's further away and closer, as opposed to on the left or the right.
Right.
Gotcha.
Where the coincidence is a lot simpler, it takes the image and you just bring it together like that.
So you would do that, and then those calculations are automatically sent down?
Down to the plotting room, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we had light radar, you know, on there too.
Mm-hmm.
And the spot one was a top director for Main Battery, they took ranges also. That was a stereoscopic rangefinder up top. So you had two different. See, I could range out to about 18,000 from turret two, which up there they could range out further because they were higher up.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a deal.
Yeah, and when you're in one of those, you know, sea battles, does it feel like it's never going to end?
Yeah, because you're waiting there and you know they're there and they're calling out. You can hear over the sound power phones the ranges that are going in. And when are they going to start shooting? Mm-hmm. They start shooting, you know, and getting to the right place and then boom. Because like I say, the guy down there in the plotting room, he's on that stable vertical. He's got the triggers pulled, but those guns aren't going to fire until they're in the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the pitch of roll of the ship.
Right. It's a lot of variables at play.
Oh, you bet. For a long time ago, too. You know what I mean? You could only calculate a problem at a plane maybe going like that, maybe 400 miles an hour. That's much you can do. They didn't go much faster than that, except if they were in a dive. And now 400 miles an hour for an airplane is a joke.
Yep.
You got guys running cars on the flats but doing 300-some miles an hour.
It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to understand what it must have been like to be you guys aboard ship when you get through with a big sea battle like that. Is there like some kind of sense of relief or, oh, that's over?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, just that was home. The ship was home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're about your business.
Where'd you sleep?
We had bunks, you know, that folded up, pipe and a canvas inside, no hammocks. It folded down, three bunks. In our compartment, they have divisions. We were F division for the fire control. First division, second division, they got their own compartments. The Marine detachment had their own compartment, just like a home.
A big family.
Big family.
How about your real family? Did you hear from them at all while you were out there?
Yeah, I get mail from my mother, my sister. Before I was aboard the ship, I could write to my mother, and I'd write her in Italian because she couldn't write too good in English. And so aboard the ship, I had to write everything in English because they censored everything that you wrote, you know.
Right.
Which was okay. No big deal.
So if you wrote it in Italian, they'd just censor the whole thing because they didn't
know
what you're saying.
They didn't have no one to you know.
Was it hard being that far away from your family?
No, because it was an adventure. You know, I probably would have never got out of Sacramento, for Christ's sakes, if it wasn't for that. You know, probably would have grown up here and stayed here and whatever. But being in the service was an adventure for me.
Did you get some shore leave? Did you get a little liberty anywhere out there in the Pacific?
The only time we got liberty, I got liberty in Hawaii on the way over. I think it was 4 hours. Then in the Admiralty Islands, we went ashore and had a couple of cans of green beer, and that was it. On the way back, Hawaii for 4 hours. I mean, there were so many people, so many servicemen that they couldn't let you stay there more than 4 hours.
Mm.
And you had to stand in line. You want to go in and have a drink. They'd give you four chips. You're allowed four drinks. So whatever you're drinking, you got four of them. Boom, they pick up the chips. When you're drinking, you got to get out of there and let someone else come in.
Move them in, move them out. How about a birthday aboard ship? Was that any different from a birthday on land?
No. I think I turned 21 coming home from Tokyo Bay. We were there at Tokyo Bay at the armistice, and on the way home, I turned 21.
Well, and there's some things you went through before then. So we talked about the Philippines, and your ship was very involved there, and you mentioned Iwo Jima. So you're one of the ships that is bombarding this real small island.
That's right. Didn't seem to hurt it. And I had a cousin that was in the Marines that landed there, and I'm looking at the... We were right close to the island. I'm through the director there. I was in secondary and looking at the landings there and just seeing them guys just terrible.
You were actually seeing that in real time. You're watching through the scope.
You bet. And
and you didn't know if one of those could have been your cousin?
No, I didn't. I couldn't tell. You know, I'd see the guys, the landing craft go boom, the guys go up there. Boom, 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 boom. That lasted. I remember we were, I forget where we came from Philippines, something. The captain said, we've got another engagement, and the sooner we get it over with, the sooner we'll be going home. He says, how about it? We turn all hands, turn two, load ammunition, everything. Yeah, let's go. So we got all loaded up and took off for Iwo Jima. And it's supposed to be like a 72-hour deal.
Yeah.
And we pulled in just before the landing started. But we got there in the morning, and they anchored us off. Mount Suribachi was on that end, we were on this end. And that's where it started right there. Start shooting. They were calling for fire, you know, and we were there for like 2 or 3 weeks. I forget how long.
Hard to believe.
Oh, and there's nothing there. I thought that was the biggest screw-up in the world. Oh, why even? I don't even know what we needed it for. They said they were going to put airplanes on it and go over to Japan, but they lost a lot. They must have got 5,000-6,000 people killed on that island.
Yeah, I think it was 6,800 Marines killed and then another 19,000 wounded.
Yeah.
How did your cousin come out?
He came out good.
Wasn't wounded or anything?
Nope. In fact, he got the Bronze Star. He was older than me, too, Faye. His name was Faye Granados.
You know, it's kind of a, not a cliche, but it's a well-repeated reality of Iwo Jima, how much bombardment took place there to such a little effect.
Oh.
So you guys thought you were probably doing a lot of damage with all the firepower you're directing.
Nothing. Didn't seem to be doing any good. Because we never did. It was always this end of the island. They had a lot of boys asking for direct fire there. And those are, you know, 1 ton. Each projectile is 1 ton.
Those 16 inches.
You have high explosive, or you got armor piercing. You set the fuse on them. And all I know is that when I'm watching through that director and watching those guys get blasted, you know what I mean? It was terrible.
Mm.
Makes you sick.
I believe it. Well, I've got to ask, because so many saw something, and maybe you weren't in the right spot to see it, but, you know, the first flag and then the second flag on top of Mount Suribachi.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a chance to see one of those?
Yeah, I was watching it.
You watched it go up?
Yeah, as a director, yeah. Yep. I don't know if it was the first or the second, but, you know.
Did that mean something to you at the time?
Yeah, I thought it'd be all over. It wasn't.
Yeah. So it was kind of a false hope.
Yeah.
You saw the Stars and Stripes, and this is a big deal.
Yeah, I thought it was all over.
And some guys have told me that on their ships, they actually heard cheers when that flag went up.
Yeah. But that was sickening. Mm. I mean, when I say sickening, I don't mean to me to watch that, you know.
Watching guys like you die.
Yeah, I can still see it. You know, guys like me, 8, 19, 20 years old.
And at the time, you don't know, your cousin could have been one of them.
No, yeah, I couldn't have. I didn't know.
How long was it till you found out that he had made it?
On the way home after Tokyo Bay, I remember going ashore in Japan in my whites, pocket full of yen. And I didn't see one Japanese person.
Hmm.
Not one. We ran around there and couldn't even get a drink of water, you know.
Hmm.
And just came back to the ship. I didn't see one Japanese person.
How about that?
They all took off. They thought, you know, we were going to eat them or a bunch of crazy sailors in whites, you know, with all this yen to spend, and we were looking for the geisha girls. I didn't see anything.
No dice.
No, I didn't see one soul.
It's break time again, but there's more to come with 96-year-old World War II veteran Arthur Ranetti. That kamikaze attack on April 1st, 1945. Really, how close of a call was that for a then 20-year-old sailor from Sacramento? We'll find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with a 96-year-old World War II veteran who sure doesn't sound 96, does he? The 12 months between his 20th and 21st birthdays were pretty eventful aboard the battleship USS West Virginia. We heard about what Arthur Ranetti endured in Surigao Straits and the Battle of Leyte Gulf, not to mention what he saw at Iwo Jima in February and March of 1945. Arthur was a fire controlman in Sky 2, calibrating ranges for the battleship to fire its array of guns.
And not too long after Iwo Jima, Okinawa, the last big battle of the war.
Yep.
And you said when the kamikazes first started in the Philippines, you'd never heard of this before.
Nope.
But when you got to Okinawa, did you expect some of that to happen?
Oh, yeah. From the Philippines, we always expected them.
Uh-huh.
The only place I never saw any kamikazes was Iwo Jima. Not one.
So, and just put it in perspective, how many do you think you saw?
Kamikazes?
Yeah.
Oh.
We're talking dozens?
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds?
Every day, you know, in the Philippines, every day.
And it might not hit your ship, but you're seeing them hit other ships.
Other ships, and we shoot them down in Okinawa. Jeez, I mean, you're talking about 20 attacks a day.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them.
So did you ever get the sense that, you know, you're just buying time, and at some point one of them's going to get through?
Mm-mm.
Never
thought that way until it got happened. Happened about 7:30 at night.
And April 1st, that's the first day of the invasion at Okinawa. It's Easter Sunday.
Easter Sunday and April Fool's Day fell on the same day.
Yeah.
it was April Fool's Day, you know, and Easter Sunday. I mean, I don't remember about if I knew it was Easter Sunday or...
Maybe they had a mass aboard ship or something.
Yeah. Well, no, they have... during the war, you'd have just... what they call general absolution for Catholic, you know, boom, boom, boom. We didn't have a mass that day. And we didn't have that. It was about 7:30 at night, just getting dark, you know.
Just after sunset.
And the planes, you know, they have to come in. They're supposed to be identified IFF, friendly or foe. They thought they were friendly. They got right over us, and the guy just flipped and came straight down. I was in the director. I'm cranking the hatch to get the hatch closed, you know. And they hit right on. We were very lucky. The motor and the bomb went through here. The wing hit the thing. The bomb went on through, and then they have an armor-piercing deck that covers all the plotting rooms and stuff. The bomb stuck in that, went into that armor-piercing deck about that far, and it was sticking straight out. But it went into this compartment. There was a motor mech, I think, sleeping in the bunk on the wall. The bomb came in right like that and stuck there. And that kid was in there because you got conditioned x-ray. Everything's locked up. He had to stay in there with that bomb.
So an unexploded bomb is wedged into the deck.
That's right.
And he can't leave.
No.
Wow. And not that your situation was very comfortable either. So you're telling me you look up.
Yeah, and here he comes.
Coming straight down.
Coming straight down.
What are you thinking in that moment?
I'm thinking, close this hatch. Because the hatch, you know, you can stick your head out. The wing hit, boom, you know, knocked the director off the roller path.
Your director?
Yeah.
So you're in for a little bit of a roller coaster ride yourself.
Yeah, I thought we were screwed up. You know, seemed a little fire running around us, getting a little hot in there.
So you're sitting in there.
Yeah.
When this plane hits, how close to you?
The wing of the plane hit the director.
That you're sitting in?
Yeah.
So you felt that impact?
We're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're dead.
And... if that bomb that got stuck in the deck would have gone off?
It would have been a lot pretty bad.
As it was, guys lost their lives.
Oh, yeah. The guys in the... it wasn't that many killed. Four of the guys in the 20-millimeter mount, you know, they're strapped in. They're screwed. They all got killed. Yeah.
How close do you think you were to getting killed?
Well, if that thing had been over a couple of feet, the guy would have hit us dead on. We'd have been all dead. There's five guys... pointer, trainer, rangefinder operator, officer, radar, five guys in there.
So it shook you. It moved you, jiggled
you
around in there.
It shook me, scared me.
Then what's happening after that impact has happened? Well, I'm sure there's some chaos that's ensuing there.
Time to get out of there.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting out of there. And then after that, I used to dream. I told you, I'd be in the water, and a Japanese guy with a big sword was whacking at me, and I'm swimming. I used to get that dream all the time.
That's what it could have been.
Swimming like hell. This guy's whacking me, but he can't catch me. But he's getting close, and I'd wake up. That was a pilot. His head went in the galley. That's where the part of the pilot, his head went into one of the big pots because they went through, you know, and the motor went in there in the galley.
His head, they didn't put it there. That's
no,
where it
no,
ended up,
that's
the end
where
of the
it
crash.
Ended up. Everybody
wow.
said, you make the beans out of that pot?
Wow.
It, you know, after so then it's joking. You got to keep the, you know.
Yeah. But this could have been a lot worse.
It could have been a lot worse. If the bomb goes off, it's a lot of people would have died.
Yeah. As it was, as you said, you lost some of those guys from the 20-millimeter anti-aircraft.
The first casualty was when we first got to the Philippines having kamikaze raids. There was a seaman they had on the searchlights. That was his battle station. You know, in the afternoon, you don't need no searchlights, but you have to go to your battle station. Well, the kamikaze come in. I was in flying, and he's shooting, bum, 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 and he... One of the machine gun bullets hit him in the leg, didn't break the bone, but went through the meaty part and everything. It showed him in and they're feeding him ice cream, and he got the purple heart. The first casualty on the ship.
Man in a searchlight that's pointless in that situation.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's how things end up, you know.
Well, after that April 1st kamikaze attack that came so close to ending your life as a very young man, was there a... burial at sea that you guys did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they just put them in the mattress covers, put some 5-inch 38 projectiles in between their legs and stuff, and overboard.
And you're watching that?
Yeah. Well, it's bad. I mean, it's, everybody's watching, you know. Guys that aren't on duty and stuff, you see that. In fact, that would you talk about the Pennsylvania, we fished one of the guys out of the water that was on the Pennsylvania, he swallowed up.
So this is a few months later. This is August, so the bombs have already been dropped.
Yep.
And did you hear about that when they dropped the bombs?
No, no. All I know is that we were on watch. In fact, my friend John Annis, my partner there, all of a sudden we see all these tracers flying off. The guys on Okinawa were shooting up in the air because celebrating because the war was over. Mm-hmm. That's how we found out.
That's your special fireworks show.
Special fireworks.
But you're talking about the Pennsylvania, so this is at Okinawa.
Yeah.
Right before, I mean, 2 days before the surrender.
2 days.
And tell me what, because you saw this happen. You saw what happened to your sister
exactly
ship.
Exactly what happened. Well, the Pennsylvania was there. The plane came in, and I think it was what they call a Judy. It's a water plane. I mean, we were just sitting, John and I were sitting up there on the director, looking on, you know, and hit right in the stern, went in that way, and boom, and the ship started to go down because it didn't have condition. No one even knew it, you know, just flying low to the water, the radar didn't pick it up or nothing, hit. So the captain was got to be a hell of a guy. He just put full shore and he beached it where it didn't sink. But I think it killed quite a few boys on that ship.
And you were saying your ship
we
brought one of those guys aboard.
Yeah, about 2 days later. It's all swollen up, flowing in the water, you know.
Mm.
Yep, bad deal. That was, you know, that's, I guess it was your turn on a couple of days before.
Yeah.
War's over, the guys gets killed in 2 days.
And I guess it never was your turn.
I guess not. I'm still here.
Yeah.
I've had a few, I should have been dead a few, two or three times, I think.
And how do you explain that? What's your...
I don't know. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know. I had things happen to me that I had to be in the hospital. They thought I was going to die two or three times, I think. Well, then you're just lucky, I guess.
I guess there must be some things you're still supposed to do.
I guess. I don't know.
So you find out the war's over by everything going off at Okinawa. But then they tell you guys, hey, you're going to be in Tokyo Bay when this is signed.
Yeah, that's in September.
So September 2nd, 1945, the battleship Missouri is where General MacArthur and all the bigwigs are.
It just came out there, and these old ships, we figured we'd put them on our old ship or one of the old ships, and what the hell are they doing on the Missouri?
So where were you guys in relation to the Mighty Mo, and did you get to see any of that happening?
Well, yeah, but we're, you know, you have to do, you couldn't see the signing or anything.
You could see the ship, and there's a lot of people aboard.
Oh, yeah. The only thing I saw, what I told you, I went ashore in Japan and didn't see one Japanese guy and ended up coming back to the ship so I could get something to eat, all of us that were on that landing craft, all dressed up in our whites.
Because the war is over.
The war is over. No action.
What did that mean to you that the war was over?
I was kind of scared. You know, I don't know if I want to come home or what, because I kind of liked it. I liked the where I was, you know. It was a big decision, really. I'm sorry I didn't make a career out of it, because I enjoyed it. Mm. I really did.
I realized something else I didn't ask you. Did you ever have to deal with any of those typhoons?
Yeah, we were in a couple of typhoons over there.
What was that like?
Bad. Very bad. You can't believe how strong the water is. You know, like the decks on the folks over, that's wood, you know.
Yeah.
So you don't have ricochet. It just splits it across. That's how powerful that water is. Bend some of the, just like the concussion of the gun, bend some of the, you had to take all the Mark 14 sights off and everything. Just like when you fire a main battery, you have to take them off the 20 millimeters and stuff. The water will just tear them off.
When one of those typhoons is at its, you know, fiercest point, where are you and what are you doing to?
I'm in either in the compartment or I'm in my battle station. And we're not too many battle stations in a typhoon. You know, so you're there to keep from getting sick.
Yeah, and if you're in your compartment,
yeah,
it's tossing you around pretty good.
Oh yeah, that's, you can't believe it. I mean, you're talking about, you know, like 20-degree roll like that. That's a lot for a battleship.
Yeah, yeah, that almost sounds as scary as kamikazes.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the kamikaze got to be something that had to be done. It was just there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you went to your battle station and everything, but you weren't scared, you know, until after something bad happens. You get hit, then you think about it. But up until then, it was just, it's your job.
And you said, you know, you weren't sure when the war was over. You kind of wanted to
stay
out there, and you wish you could have stayed in the Navy.
Yeah.
Did you have any friends who didn't get to come home, who were killed in World War II?
I had friend of their family member, Eddie Filotti. He didn't want to go into service. He said, I'm going to get killed. I'll never forget that. Oh, don't worry about it, Eddie. So he stated he got drafted in the Army, and Normandy didn't even hit the beach. Boom.
Ugh.
That was it. He's buried over there.
In Normandy?
Yeah, his parents, they went over to see the gravesite, you know, but he just had a premonition, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, Eddie Filotti. Yeah, his father had a restaurant on L Street in Sacramento called the La Rosa, Italian restaurant.
I don't want to leave anything important out. If there's anything else you want to get in there, feel free. But I do want to make sure to, well, I want to make sure to thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling this story. But I've got to ask you about the honor flight, too. So you got to go back to Washington, D.C.
I thought that was really great. It was a nice deal. I mean, my daughter went with me. She was my caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
We had a nice time. It was a great deal. I couldn't believe it that they did that, you know, how nice that is. Everything was done perfect. Wherever we went, put you in a bus, clear the road, pal. Just
that police escort's pretty
nice. Every place we went was great, really. I couldn't believe it how they handled everything like that, you know. Didn't even have time to really have any drinks, for crying out loud. No, really, you had so much to do, you know.
I've had a lot of vets tell me that having the police escort was their favorite part of the whole
experience. It was amazing. They had this guy that was huge that ran on a motorcycle, and I'll tell you what, clear the road. You didn't have to wait. There was nothing. We went from point A to point B, boom, that was it. Point B to point C, boom, no problem.
I guess that means you're pretty important.
I thought that was one hell of a deal. It was a great trip. I got to tell you a real story.
I do have to ask, when you were in Washington and you went to that World War II memorial and they've got all those gold stars.
Oh, I was just showing a picture of it to Karen because we were there with the reunion, the ship reunion. They hadn't had that wall built yet. So then when my daughter and I went on that flight, they had it done. I took pictures of that thing. And boy, you talk about, you look at that and there's 100 dead people for every star. It's something else.
What did that make you think about as you stood there and looked at that?
I thought about them poor guys I knew that they're dead. You know what I mean? I just thought about it. And the first thing I thought when I looked at that thing was when I was watching that invasion of Iwo. That was bad. I mean, I see the guys get, you know, we know we've got some guys on a ship that got killed, but watching that happen and happen and happen and happen, I just can't forget that.
Understandable.
That's hard to forget, you know.
Yeah.
I just can't forget that. That was a bad deal. really bad for them young jarheads.
Do you remember what it says? They've got a few words under those stars. Do you remember what it says there?
Yeah, for the price of freedom, yeah. Something about the price of freedom that you get the 4,054 some stars, like 100 for each star.
That's right. Here we mark the price of freedom.
Yep. That's one. You look at that and you just, and that the final statue of that Iwo Jima memorial, that's something else, pal.
Well, is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you think people ought to know?
No, I'm just about giving you my whole deal there.
Let me ask you a tough question. I know you're not just looking back because you're looking forward to going hunting again this fall in Colorado and celebrating your 97th birthday and all of that. But when you do kind of look back, when you think about 96 years, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm very thankful that I'm still here, you know. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be here. She's helped me through a lot of tough things. Oh, yeah, look at that. See, protected by a well-armed woman.
Your T-shirt says protected by a well-armed woman.
Yeah.
So does that mean don't mess with you or don't mess with her?
Don't mess with her. Okay. She takes care of me. No, but, I mean, she's been very important to me. And it's actually, so I would have been dead.
Who's a better shot?
Well, I taught her, so... Students kind of overtaken the teacher. She shoots good. Being that she enjoys it, it makes it not easier for me, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's our vacation every year. Instead of going wherever we're going to go or someplace, we look forward to that. We take our time going, driving over there, have stop here and for the night, have dinner, have a couple of drinks, go a little further, you know, and just enjoy the trip. We shoot a good animal, and we bring the meat all home, and we give a lot of it away, and that's all the meat, but that's what we eat.
Right.
We eat antelope, we eat deer, and we eat elk. I haven't had a beef steak in I don't know how long.
Is that your secret, to staying so young?
I don't know, but we, you know, we eat well. We eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and we have our vegetables, but with the meat, there's no cholesterol in it.
Yeah, high in protein.
No fat, you know. We eat ducks and doves.
Yeah.
I love dove, and we have ducks every once in a while.
You must have a good freezer.
Yeah, well, we've got about four in the garage there.
Yeah, I do have one more question, last question. I'm just thinking about your grandson on this coffee mug here, and you said you had three great-grandkids.
Yeah.
What do you think your great-grandkids and people of their generation?
I feel sorry for them.
You do?
Oh, what they're going to face?
The world?
If this keeps going like this?
Yeah.
I don't want my wife to go walking alone. When I grew up, you'd never even lock the doors on a house. Really?
Oh, even me, yeah. Well, what do you think they should know about World War II and you and all the guys who...
They've asked me about it. My grandson was very interested in that.
What do you tell them? What do you think is important to remember?
I don't tell them any of the bad stuff, you know. They had a good time.
Do you think you did something that matters, that's important?
I don't know if I did or not, you know. You're asking a teenager, you know, if I did something important. Well, I don't know.
You gave up some of the best years of your life.
Yes, I did that, but...
We're not speaking German or Japanese.
No, and I'm spoke, but I had a good time. So I think of the good times. And actually on the ship, other than when we were in the condition red, I mean, life on the ship was good.
Arthur Renetti, 96 years young. Don't forget to find photos of Mr. Renetti then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.